There's a book that I read a couple of weeks ago that I've been ruminating on and has since sort of turned up in all sorts of places, including some television shows and interviews that I've seen with the author. And that could just be a bit of what we consider the frequency illusion, which is that it's like when you buy a new car and suddenly all the cars on the road that you see are your car. That is a frequency illusion because it's not like there were suddenly more of that car, or at least not any more or less than there probably was the day before. It's just that you're noticing it now. But the book that I read was Stolen Focus, Why You Can't Pay Attention and How to Think Deeply Again by Johan Hari. And the book makes some pretty lofty goals and some promises and some pretty lofty thoughts, some of which I think are pretty absurd and some of them I think are rather holistic. And the author, I think, comes from an unusual point, an unusual life position. That is certainly privileged. And I suspect that if he were sitting across this table from me right now, he would probably agree with that sentiment to some extent. But overall, I think the book was interesting and gets into a topic that I've had a lot of casual interest in lately, which is about focus and attention. So to start this, let me just read the sort of the description in the book jacket of the book. He starts off and he says, in the United States, teenagers can focus on one task for only 65 seconds at a time, and office workers average only 3 minutes. Like so many of us, Johan Hari was finding that constantly switching from device to device and tab to tab was a diminishing and depressing way to live. He tried all sorts of self-help solutions, even abandoning his phone for 3 months, but nothing seemed to work. So Hari went on an epic journey across the world to interview the leading experts on human attention, and he discovered that everything we think we know about this crisis is wrong. We think our inability to focus is a personal failure to exert enough willpower over our devices. The truth is even more disturbing, that our focus has been stolen by powerful external forces that have left us uniquely vulnerable to corporations determined to raid our attention for profit. Hari found that there are 12 deep causes of this crisis, from the decline of mind wandering to rising pollution, all of which have robbed some of our attention. In Stolen Focus, he introduces readers to Silicon Valley dissidents who learn to hack human attention and veterinarians who diagnose dogs with ADHD. He explores a favela in Rio de Janeiro where everyone lost their attention in a particularly surreal way, and an office in New Zealand that discovered a remarkable technique to restore workers' productivity. Crucially, Hari learned how we can reclaim our focus as individuals and as a society if we are determined to fight for it. Stolen Focus will transform the debate about attention and finally show us how to get it back. Now, that is an incredibly lofty set of topics, and I will probably not touch on all of them, but I did have some notes. I actually ended up listening to the audiobook version of this, which was recorded by Hari, and I will say that I did not know anything about him. Apparently, he's written some other books that people find very good, one of which was about dealing with depression. He's British. He's a journalist, and if this name sounds somewhat familiar, I believe this, I think it was with The Guardian, but it could have been with The Independent. I don't have the note in front of me. He was involved in some sort of scandal regarding plagiarism, and that booted him out of whatever that organization was. And so, you know, he's now into this vein of writing books and doing other journalism in other places. Those elements aside, some of the things that I wrote down as I was listening to this book and sort of ruminating on it, I will say first that there are many books on this topic. We've talked about a bunch of them. One of the first that I read about this was Deep Work by Cal Newport. There are other books. I think that Johan Hari has probably the most comprehensive and holistic of a lot of these other sources and books. So if you imagine that some of these other folks are talking about how to focus on this one thing, and or that other people are talking about how diet affects our attention, or how exercise can improve our wellness, or how you know, Silicon Valley types operate, and how we sort of engineer things about social media and whatnot, this book, Stolen Focus, brings a lot of those things together with much more breadth, not quite as much depth, obviously, just because of the size of the book. But I think it's very good. As sort of a one-time resource. Like if you were casually interested in lots of these different things and you're like, which book should I read that can give me a really good overview of lots of these different topics, this would probably be one that would be worth picking up. Because if you read it and you discovered, you know what, I think I'd like to know more about how diet and nutrition can impact a person's focus and their work capabilities and their productivity, then you could probably then pick up the sources that he cites in these books to go find those authors to read those books in more depth and detail about those particular topics. He cites other folks in here as well, like the author of the original Flow book. And then there's Tristan Harris, who is the Center for Humane Technology, who got his start on, at least the first time that I heard from him was shortly after he had left Google. He started this foundation to talk about how engineers are sort of working to improve the attention that we give to Silicon Valley companies like Google and Facebook and others. I first heard about him and his work on Real Time with Bill Maher, where he was a guest on there. I think that that, for a lot of people, was the first time that he sort of entered into a mainstream spot and then started getting a lot more attention from that. But back to Johan Hari, he sort of starts this book with his background on a lot of this stuff, and his background isn't really any different than probably any other number of office workers and knowledge workers and creative types operating in the Western Hemisphere today, which is that we've all got a bunch of stuff to do. Our phones keep dinging at us a lot. There are a lot of different notifications and distractions throughout our day. Social media seems like this thing that we're kind of have to somehow be plugged into or engaged with, or that we've done it sort of voluntarily, and that it's not really working for us in some way, but we can't quite pinpoint why. And so his particular solution to this problem was that he was going to go live for 3 months at the end of Provincetown and not take his phone or a laptop with him. And I guess that's fine. To be clear, he took his laptop with him, but he took one that didn't have the ability to access the internet. I think he found something that had like a broken radio or something in it, so that way he couldn't pair it with his phone or whatever, or with a Wi-Fi network. So, I mean, I guess fine. It's an interesting experiment, right? It makes for an interesting story. I don't fault him for this. The fault that I have with this is that it's so absurdly privileged in a way that just does not strike, I think, most normal people as a thing that they can do. It's like, no, I'm probably not going to be able to spend 90 days with an out of office responder on my email and people will be okay with that. That just isn't going to happen for most people in most places. I think about the group that I think about the most when I read things like that are Amazon Fulfillment Center workers, because I feel like those are, there are so many of those people, and there are so many people like them in other distribution facilities that seem to have gobbled up so much of what was the remnants of the labor pool of the Midwest and parts of the South and West. And I just can't imagine somebody that works at like an Amazon Fulfillment Center reading this and thinking, yes, I too would love to just go to the end of Provincetown in a gay paradise and spend my entire 3 months there in the spring or the summer and just sort of walk around the beach and think, right? A useful endeavor. I think that we've had lots of people who've done this sort of thing over the years. Henry David Thoreau being one that comes to mind very clearly as somebody who sort of cast away the aspersions of city life and went to Walden Pond, where he wrote most of his great works. I think there's a lot of value in that, because there's lots of times in history where good things come from that. Queen, as one example, the band, wrote Bohemian Rhapsody when they went and sort of locked themselves in a cabin in the English countryside together. The thing is that he didn't actually, at least I don't think, he didn't write most of this book when he was there. I think he wrote maybe some of it, and don't hold me to this part, but I think maybe he wrote some of it there, but then wrote a good chunk of it after he had spent the 90 days there. And he also wrote about, too, how he sort of slipped back into his old problems with sort of being distracted on Twitter all the time and his incessant email and so forth. And that, you know, he spent all that time away, realized what it felt like to not be attached to some of these things, then came back and sort of fell back into all the same problems again. And somehow this is sort of where we kick off in this book about what the hell can people do if, you know, how can real people in real situations and real scenarios actually make an effort to improve their focus and attention. He talks to a lot of different experts about a lot of different things. I'm not going to talk about all of them here, but one of the ones that sort of stuck out to me that I hadn't heard a whole lot before is the role of nutrition in our diet on our focus. And on a high level, anyone could hear that and be like, well, of course, you know, if you get a, you know, eat a bunch of sugar for breakfast, you're probably going to kind of be lagging towards the middle of the day. And if you have a diet that's full of junk that sort of harms your body in various ways, it also harms your mind. Seems totally obvious. I don't think that anybody disputes that sort of thing. I think a lot of people may not be totally aware of what they should do about it in a lot of cases. And I think there's probably even far more people who have no ability to do anything about it because they either live or work in environments that just won't tolerate many other options. You know, like if you're a, like, again, if you're an Amazon fulfillment center worker, your lunch is probably confined to what you can sort of cram into a small lunchbox. And if you get to eat at all, what that is that you eat probably isn't something that you can sort of freshly prepare, right? And even if it's leftovers, that might be problematic because I've also heard that there's often not a lot of ability to sort of even reheat things in a microwave, for example. So there's limits to what some people can do in certain situations. But he writes that we have a social problem causing obesity. And he says that we have bad food and bad cities, like our urban layouts and things that are sort of inducing people to drive more and whatever, and that it's making us fat. And he says that the focus, that focus as itself, focus and attention on things, is itself a social problem. I wrote down a note when I was thinking about that, about body positivity, because he kind of comes out and says that, that, you know, it's making us fat. And I don't disagree with him in this notion that we should just call things what they are. I think that there is a moment or at least a threshold in people's lives where they probably go from not fat to fat. And it might be a gray area in there, but I don't understand at this point in my life why we as a culture and a society seem so inclined to try and promote things under the notion of body positivity, that if you are obese, that we try to explain away the medical issues, the valid medical issues that come from that, and instead try to say, well, you can't say bad things about that because people should feel good about themselves. It's like, well, yes, you should feel good about yourself, but this would have been like, it strikes me as like, this would have been like if people smoked and instead of saying, you know, smoking is bad for you, it can kill you, it causes cancer, it's terrible for everyone around you and for you, and you should stop doing that. Like that's the response to smoking, straight up, right? Like the science is very clear on that. I don't think anybody disagrees with that. I don't even think smokers disagree with that. You can agree that it's like, well, I don't care about that sort of thing, and so I'm going to do it myself, and I'm going to do it to myself. That's fine. Like you can do that. That has a societal cost still because you are still part of society, but you would never argue to say, well, I think that's not right. I think that smoking is fine, and I think that, you know, it's fine for other people, and that you're just not being positive about my choices. It's like, well, that's not what we're trying to say here. And so I feel like the body positivity thing is kind of in that same vein. I think he kind of broaches this in the book a little bit, but he doesn't actually use those words necessarily. That his overall point is that we've got a bunch of crappy food, bunch of crappy culture and a bunch of crappy cities and environments that we all live in that are inducing us to be fat. And that's causing us to have lots of problems with our health. And those things also detract from our attention and our focus. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable argument to make. And it sort of slipped in, and it's not something that I've seen or heard much about in a lot of the interviews that he's given. It seems to kind of get glossed over. And I think it may be one of the most important things in the book that he talks about, because it's the one thing that systemically is legitimately a thing that we have inflicted on lots of people. We have inflicted a world upon a lot of people and a lot of our children today that prohibit them from being able to be active, like biking in the street or being able to walk places or being able to do anything that enables them to sustainably exercise their bodies and their minds. Because we've kind of created the worst possible culture in a lot of ways for a lot of that stuff. And so I like that point, and I want to bring that up because I think it's maybe one of those important ones that he makes in the book. He also writes in here that a society that can't focus is keen to gravitate towards authoritarian regimes with simplistic answers. And I read, you know, I heard this as he was saying it, and I get his point, which is that if a large number of people are completely incapable of nuanced, deep understanding of issues and problems and situations affecting either their local communities or even sort of national and global initiatives, that whoever has the simplest, shortest answer wins, right? That makes complete and total sense. And I think there is a nugget of truth in there to that. I just don't think that it's entirely true because I think it needs more study. And I personally am conflicted on this because I think people could focus fine in the 30s, right? I think that the things people were focused on in the 1930s and the 1940s, as one example, of when we had certain large global problems with authoritarian regimes, I don't think anybody was running around saying that people were too unfocused on things, that somehow the newspapers were distracting people, and that, oops, accidentally, the Nazis have come into power, right? That argument holds up today in a way that doesn't hold up in the 1930s. I think you can say that authoritarian regimes exist today in places, including maybe even in the United States, depending on your political views, that an electorate that is not literate about the problems affecting the society at large and that gets a lot of their news from social media and things that are incredibly bite-sized chunks of things, tweet-length bits of news, are inherently dangerous and can, yes, potentially allow people to become distracted and elect authoritarian regimes. Like I said, I don't think that's entirely true because I think people in the 1930s were at the very least considerably deeper thinkers about lots of things than what we are or what we would consider or think about ourselves being today. I think there's a lot of nuance to that. It's sort of like when you say that kids today don't know how to do X, Y, and Z. I think kids today know how to do lots of things, many more things than children did of generations ago. I think those things are just different and that sometimes when people's certain pet issues that they want people to know about don't get disseminated in the right ways or enough, that people kind of get testy about those sorts of things. I just think that the way that people approach the way that we think about issues today lacks a certain nuance to it that I feel like we probably had in the 1930s and 40s, at least here domestically in the United States, that certainly does not exist today, or at least exists in almost unimaginably different ways than how they exist today. Again, he sort of casually makes that point. He has much different views on governance and policy, which we'll get to in a second, that is worth discussing. He also writes in here a note that I hadn't given much thought to, which is that fiction builds empathy because, as research that he cites and suggests, you can imagine yourself in someone's head and practice understanding other characters when you read fiction. Nonfiction doesn't do that, and that empathetic people could just be inclined to read fiction. There have actually been studies on this, particularly with children, that if you expose children to works of fiction, that they then demonstrate characteristics that we would associate with being largely more empathetic towards other real human beings. Not a bad thing to study and think about and encourage children to do. But you could also argue that empathetic people just naturally are already inclined to read fiction. And so therefore, those two things, causation isn't equal to the whole equation there on that. But that some research shows that this is still partially true because even with kids who pick their own books, those children develop a better understanding of other people when they're given sort of a wide spectrum of books to read from lots of different topics. I don't have much more to add to that. I just think it's interesting, partly because I recognize after doing some research on my reading habits from last year, is that 99%, literally 99% of what I read is nonfiction. I just have never really loved fiction that much. I have a particular interest in narrative nonfiction with a little bit of business and self-help stuff, if it's not obvious from the kind of books that I've been talking about lately. But this made me sort of stand up and think maybe I should at least try to be an adult about this and try to find works of fiction that I might actually enjoy reading. He also goes in here to say that Harvard research says that mind wandering, I think we can also call this just daydreaming, is a road to ruminations and bad feelings. And that people report mind wandering as their least happiest moments, and that you need focus on something else. And so the impetus there being that when we let our minds wander, people generally feel very sad or very depressed, because where their mind wanders for one reason or another, it makes them realize sort of where they're not, I guess, is one example, right? Like if I sat here and I just sort of stared out the window for a while, my mind could wander and I could think, you know, I wish the street had, you know, greener trees, right? Or I wish the snow wasn't muddy and gross like it currently is outside my window. Or that I wish that I was in a cabin someplace in the woods, or that I, you know, lived in a house, you know, like he does on the end of Provincetown in Cape Cod, or that, you know, any number of other things, right? And that as a coping mechanism for this, we all try to focus on something else. And that focus tends to be little bite-sized chunks of things like social media. We reach for our phone and we use, you know, poke at Facebook or Instagram or whatever it might be. And that's interesting to me because it's something that I've actually been trying to increase the amount of time that I do, to just sort of sit and think, you know, without a lot of other stuff kind of around me. I'm the sort of person that historically I have always filled sort of empty time. Like if I'm doing the dishes or I'm doing laundry or I'm vacuuming or whatever, I'm going to put my headphones in and I'm going to listen to a podcast, or I'm going to listen to a book, or I'm going to do something that seems somewhat productive to me. I've tried to make an effort to reduce that amount of time and actually just sort of do those sorts of things in silence, or just sort of in my own head to see where my thoughts go. And I, at this point, really can't tell you whether that's been better or worse or neutral for me at this point. I really don't have an opinion about it. I'm passionately ambivalent about that so far. But this stuck out to me because it was top of mind that mind wandering is a road to ruminations and bad feelings, according to Harvard researchers. So there you go. I guess if that makes you feel bad, then listen to some music or something. There are other parts of this book where he makes points that seem so flatly absurd to me that I don't even know why they're even in the book. At one point, talking about social media, and he talks about, as he introduces Tristan Harris, and sort of how every time you pick up your phone and you try to resist looking at something, or you try to resist doing something, that there's 10,000 engineers on the other end of this phone trying to get you to do the exact opposite. An example that he cites is that within Google, the Gmail team realized that if they just sort of toggled everyone's notifications on for email, that people would get more attention in the app, and more attention in the app meant more advertising revenue. And that just is the general element of their business. A fundamental component of that is that the more time you spend looking at them, you know, Gmail, Facebook, social media apps, whatever of your choice, the more time you spend looking at those things and the less time you spend looking at other things means more money for them. And that's, you know, everyone's got 24 hours a day. And so if you can just sort of cut into that pie in any way you can, then you should do that because it will give you more money. Netflix has famously always said that they're competing with sleep. That people, you know, as the largest chunk of time that people spend in a day is usually asleep. If you assume 24 hours, about 8 hours of sleep, a third of your day is just devoted to that. And if you can sort of cut into that somehow or another, because people's other responsibilities aren't going to move, then you can get more people to watch Netflix, and more people watching Netflix means more revenue. And one of his arguments in this whole component is how companies, specifically Facebook, have engineered themselves to be sort of privacy abusive, sort of drilling into like what it is that we're doing and what we're reading and what we're seeing and how we're seeing it, and the algorithms that sort of promote which posts go, which posts don't. That the solution to this, according to the author, is that one possible situation could be that the government should just sort of make these into public utilities and take them over and run them like we do like the water company or something. And I sort of read that and I almost threw the phone across the room because I was at that point, I was like, really? I mean, has this guy even been to America? I don't, maybe that'll fly in Britain. I don't know. But like, that just strikes me as so absurdly bizarre and wrongheaded and impossible. It's just so flatly absurd that I just don't even know why that's even in the book. I don't even know why an editor would look at that and be like, you know, and you might as well put it after it that, yeah, I mean, I guess aliens could descend from the planet, whatever, whatever, and take over Facebook, you know, or that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg could join a cult and the cult could co-opt his mind and replace him with some sort of robot overlord that then, you know, they use to sort of attack Facebook from within or something. Like, those things seem almost as likely to me as the United States Congress and the United States government coming together and saying, you know what we should do is we should just sort of take over Facebook. Because the constitutional concerns about separation of media and the Fourth Estate and government and all sorts of things aside, it's just bonkers to me. But as I complain about that sort of thing, I will say that I like how Johan Hari made an obvious effort to claim where a lot of the research in his book was very convinced. He was upfront about it at the front of the book as well, where he says, you know, I'm going to tell you that the research that I'm about to cite about topic XYZ, these researchers and scientists all over the world seem to be in complete agreement about this sort of stuff. And that in other places that the researchers are conflicted, and that in other places the research is not very good because of one reason or another, or is just maybe even downright wrong for one reason or another, and what people are saying about that. And he was very clear and upfront with that. Perhaps that's a end result of him having been found out for plagiarizing back when he was working as a journalist, that maybe you should cite these things and people should be able to decide these things for themselves, or at least that you shouldn't try to hide them. But I appreciate how he made a very obvious effort to do that. It was very approachable. It seemed very straightforward to me. It didn't catch me off guard. And unlike a lot of places where you just sort of think, yeah, but who says, like, you know, you hear like researchers say, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, well, do they, you know, like, who are those people? What were they paid for? Who paid for what they're researching and all that sort of stuff? Or maybe in other times you just sort of gloss over it. He put that up front in a way, and I appreciate that. I also appreciate that he was trying to find ways to put matters into perspective and to practice these things himself and to sort of find a solution, even if they were a bit privileged. It was like, yes, one solution is potentially that you could throw your phone into the river. One solution is that you could put an out-of-office responder on your email for 3 months of the year and go hang out in you know, Provincetown. Are those things approachable for most people most of the time? I don't know. They are definitely a solution. I think these are hard problems, and that's why I think these solutions aren't great in a lot of ways. I think that he would make the argument that a lot of the things that he talks about in the book in terms of what's stealing our focus is that we have these large companies and corporations and things that are putting pressure on us in ways that, we as mere mortals just cannot withstand, right? Like, there's just no way to resist Facebook. And actually, there's a very good way of resisting Facebook is that you just don't freaking look at it. You just don't look at it, right? If your email's overflowing because you're constantly burned out by it, the solution there is that you've got a bad job and that you should get a different job. And I agree that as solutions go, deleting Facebook off your phone is capable. Anybody can do that. Literally, there is no excuse why nobody can't do that. There are valid reasons why some people may not be able to move or switch jobs or careers or whatever. And so that's a different set of problems. And just as there's a different set of problems that most people most of the time probably can't all go live out on a farmstead, you know, in the outskirts of Montana, away from, you know, the entirety of civilization. And so, you know, I appreciate that he was trying to put these things into a model where people could put some practice into these solutions. These are hard problems. I think that he makes the approach that these things are impossible to resist when in reality, not all of these things are impossible to resist. They're just very hard. It's like exercise, right? Like, there is no reason why most people most of the time are precluded from exercising. It's just very hard because you have to kind of know what to do and you kind of have to have time to do it and, you know, carve that routine into your life. And that's a hard thing for a lot of people to do for very obvious and very valid reasons. At any rate, stolen focus, By Johan Hari, Why You Can't Pay Attention and How to Think Deeply Again is an interesting book. I gave it 4 stars. I think you'll like this book if you like something that's informative, like something that's holistic. Like I said, if you kind of want a overarching review of lots of things, this is a great way to get that from lots of different sources as one book. And I think you'll like this book if you want something that sort of makes you reflect on yourself and your own life and how you feel about the technology and the services and the way that you communicate with other people around you.